Welcome to this episode of our special podcast series, a collaboration between ASTCT Talks and Cancer Network. In each episode, we dive into the latest developments and challenges in the treatment of multiple myeloma, T-cell malignancies, and other pivotal topics in oncology, hematology, stem cell transplantation, and cellular therapy. Join us as we speak with leading experts, uncover new research insights, and tackle key issues facing healthcare professionals today.
For those of you tuning in or listening later, today's May 30th, 2025, first day of the 2025 ASCO annual meeting. It's my privilege to be joined here by two of my esteemed colleagues. This is a joint podcast between Cancer Network and the ASTCT, the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy. We'll be talking about some, not even all, not even half of all the cool abstract and hematologic malignancies being presented at this meeting. So maybe I can just have all the hosts introduce ourselves. I can go first. My name is Rahul Banerjee, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle, focused on myeloma and CAR-T therapy. And that's what I'll kind of talk about today.
Thank you, Rahul. I'm Taha Al-Johashi. I'm here at University of Oklahoma College of Medicine, Assistant Professor. I'm also Associate Director for the Transplant Cell Therapy Program. And I'm interested in everything cell therapy and transplant.
Hey, this is Salman Faisal. I am an attending physician in transplant cell therapy at University of Oklahoma. Taha, I'm interested in transplant cell therapy, and I'm presenting you live from ASCO.
Wonderful. How was it there so far, Salman?
Pretty good.
But chaotic, I'm sure, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Great. So maybe I can go first, as long as you both don't mind. You know, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this one, too. So I think it's one of the biggest ones. I think this is a big year for myeloma, in particular, from a CAR-T perspective. And there's several really nice trials being presented at the ASCO meeting that worth discussing. I think the biggest one will be presented by Dr. Peter Voorhees. I actually don't remember which day. I have to open up the meeting in a separate view, but it is being presented. It is abstract number 7507, entitled Long-Term 5-Year Remission and Survival After Treatment with Siltacaptagene autoleucel in CARTITUDE-1 Patients with Relapsed or Refractory Multiple Myeloma. And so, you know, the reason this matters is we in the myeloma field are behind our lymphoma colleagues. I'd love to hear, Taha, if you view CAR-T to be, you know, curative and what cure fractions you say to your patients with lymphoma when you do treat lymphoma patients. You know, for us in myeloma, we typically don't use that word cure. In the Legend 2 study, one of the earliest Legend studies of the CAR-T product targeting BCMA that ended up becoming cilta-cel, you know, I think at that point it was 18% of people were alive and disease-free at 5 years. But, you know, a lot of those, you know, done in China, early days of CAR-T, different dose levels, not all patients got modern lymphodepletion. CARTITUDE-1 enrolled several years ago, and I think that's a study that is more relevant to current U.S. practice, really international practice, in terms of how CAR-T is delivered. Because, you know, they get Flu-Cy conditioning, they get the modern dose range of cilta-cel, which is a very Salama-derived BCMA-targeting CAR-T therapy product. We knew in the past already that the median PFS was about 3 years or so. That was presented by Dr. Yi Lin and colleagues, I think, 2 ASCOs ago. Now we're seeing, it's not really an encore presentation, actually it's more than that, because now we're seeing 5-year data from this. 97 patients treated on this study. Again, these are patients median 6 prior lines of therapy. You know, these patients truly, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, in any other setting apart from CAR-T therapy, they all would have died. 6 prior lines of therapy on average, many had more, many had several transplants, several other therapies that had failed and so forth. And here, of those 97 patients, 33% of them are alive and disease-free. That's what we know so far from the abstract. Obviously, Dr. Voorhees will present more when he actually presents the data, but that's awesome. You know, in other settings, sometimes we say that, you know, 5 years disease-free is what you would call cure. Again, I don't know that I'm ready to use that word in myeloma just yet. It's going to take a lot more to get me there, but truly, these are patients who are off treatment, right? Like, for all intents and purposes, you know, they are probably, knock on wood, at least some of them are never going to need myeloma treatment ever again in their life. And that's extraordinary, especially for this heavily pretreated patient population. You know, we're going to be looking for more details about the safety profile of cilta-cel. Remember that CARTITUDE-1 also has had issues. So, you know, 10 of the 97 patients went on to get secondary MDS, myelodysplasia, or AML. It's tricky because you don't know for sure, was that the CAR-T that caused it, or was it the fact that they'd had 6 prior lines of treatment, including lenalidomide, transplant, more transplants, etc., which all could predispose patients to myeloid malignancies. And then the myeloma went into remission, and they lived long enough to get some other problem instead of dying from the myeloma. It's tricky, but that's one thing I definitely want to hear more cases about. There was 3 additional patients who reported a second primary malignancy, so I'd love to get more details about that. This particular study, there was a 6% incidence of Parkinson's disease. There were no new cases of movement or neurocognitive disorders. For those listening in who don't follow the BCMA CAR-T space as well, this has been a problem with cilta-cel for sure, where in CARTITUDE 1, again, 6% of patients went on to get something very similar to Parkinson's disease, where we think that there's rapid lymphocyte expansion, CAR-T expansion, it gets into places it shouldn't be. For example, the basal ganglia of the brain, and there is, we think, some BCMA expression there, and that can cause problems. That rate's come down. So in CARTITUDE 4, which we can talk about separately, it was down to like 0.6% as opposed to 6%, but it's still a problem. So at least here, that incidence is not going up with time. But I think for me, it'd be really interesting to see that subset, 1/3 of patients who are alive and disease-free at 5 years, what percent of them are actually truly like healthy and feeling well versus have a second cancer or have Parkinson's disease or something like that. You know, even if none of them do, and 33% is alive, disease-free, and doing awesomely, that is still too low, right? We need to get that number higher. And we think that with earlier leveraging of CAR-T already, we'll talk about CARTITUDE 4, also being presented at ASCO by Dr. Surabhi Sidhana and colleagues, that we think that CAR-T in earlier lines may work better. There may be a plateau to that, right? We don't know if it's better in frontline or even smoldering, which some people are doing. But I don't know. I think definitely 6 prior lines for CAR-T is probably too late, in my view, for the sweet spot. So it may end up being earlier, more like CARTITUDE 4. We'll see if in newer studies of CAR-T, you start seeing better, quote-unquote, cure fractions. Again, I don't know if I'm truly willing to say that 5 years alive disease-free is cure, but it's much better than what we're used to in myeloma. So I'll call that a win. And anything you would add, Taha or Salman, about that particular one?
I think they're remarkable results, honestly. I agree with everything you've said. To me, like seeing, 30% at 5 years, that's remarkable. Not very different from what we've seen with the long follow-up on the ZUMA-1 in large B-cell lymphoma, where we actually have proven that at least some of the patients can be cured with the therapy. And as you know, the experience obviously with lymphoma is a little bit ahead of the myeloma world. We have seen, you know, repeatedly with earlier use of CAR-T, you get at least better safety, maybe even better efficacy. Only gets better from there because these are, like you said, they're the heaviest treated patients.
Agreed. To pivot to maybe one of you?
Honestly, most of the studies that caught my eyes are benchmarking studies in lymphoma with CAR-T. The first one I want to highlight is abstract number 7023 by Dr. Furkan and colleagues. And this is looking into outcomes of outpatient versus inpatient exa-cel and CD19, exa-cel in large B-cell lymphoma. And they really looked at a very nice matched cohort, outpatient versus inpatient infusion, and they've shown very nicely very similar outcomes, including as we have what we have seen in our own experience here at OU as an outpatient CAR-T program, and then some other programs have reported their data too, that you can at least spare 25% of the patients hospitalization altogether by doing it outpatient. It was nice to see that coming out of real world utilization of CAR-T and from CIBMTR data. That's why first I'm going to mention another benchmarking study and then see if Salman has anything else to also add. This one is abstract number 7026. By Dr. Kamdar and colleagues, and it's looking into essentially toxicities and the timeline for toxicities in a large data set of liso-cel, again, relapse refractory large B-cell lymphoma. They looked into 702 patients from multiple clinical trials in CLL, mantle cell follicular lymphoma, and in addition to about 177 patients from the CIBMTR registry. And they really very nicely shown in their abstract that the vast majority of the toxicities will happen within the first 14 days, at least with the liso-cel. More than 90% of the toxicity. Most of us in the field, I'm not sure what you guys are doing in Seattle, but most other programs now are really big on the first 14 days and then kind of like ease up from there. After 14 days, you can relax a little bit, at least with this product. And this is a very nice study to show that.
Agreed. This is awesome. Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It's not even just about clinical care, but also the disparities, right? Like there are some patients where truly, if you told me to spend 2 weeks in the big city and moving, they could do it, but it's like 4 weeks. And then right now it's 4 weeks of CRS monitoring and then another 4 weeks not even being able to drive per the FDA package insert. That's really tough. Out of curiosity, and I don't use Lysacel as often, obviously, even although I attend on that service sometimes, I feel like at least for some of the myeloma CAR-Ts, they're still pretty cytopenic and have other stuff going on at week 3 and 4. Lysacel obviously tends to be a more forgiving product, I know. Do you find that at least from week 3 and 4, truly, like, even if you don't need physician assistance for like physicians, like leadership for like CRS and ICANS, are they pretty active hematologically? Or do you think a lot of these patients, for example, after 2 weeks, truly could just go home and just be seen like once a week or something by a community doc?
Yeah, great question. A good percentage of them will still have counts issues, probably mostly the consequence of the lymphodepletion. You know,
right.
Fludarabine is very myelosuppressive. But nevertheless, it's good to see that late toxicities and late hospitalizations are not a big thing, at least in this abstract. And I would definitely say these patients will still need lab checks and maybe growth factors, transfusions, but it can be done safely outpatient. And in all honesty, at least in our practice, we like to engage the community doctors too. They can get their counts checked by their closer doctor and get whatever they need. Obviously, Rahul, this puts on us as a field, as a CAR-T program, to like work with our local doctors and provide guidance to them on what needs to be done.
Completely agreed. And then to be clear, at Oklahoma City, for example, we do not use remote patient monitoring. Like, it's not like we're sending them out with like one of those like Apple Watch style devices or something to like check their heart rate all the time. I presume you're probably not doing that either, right?
No, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I agree. Yeah. No, I mean, we also think there'd be a high-tech solution and maybe the solution was in front of us the whole time, that maybe 4 weeks is not necessary for the majority of patients, or it should be personalized. Obviously, as you said, if someone's super cytopenic or still something going on or infection, that is not a good time to kick them out just because of 15 days. But at least for some of these patients, they could go. I wonder, I've talked to Dr. Shodman about, I know that there's some hope to someday change the FDA package insert. I don't know, do either of you know anything if they are hoping to actually get there someday to actually change what the package insert says?
I've heard some people talking about it, like revisiting the REMS, obviously that's happening, revisiting some of these restrictive language, and also the driving for 60 days is a bit tough on patients, in all honesty, like not to drive, especially if they haven't had toxicities. To a lot of them, you know, it doesn't make sense. I think now we have the data to show that. We have hundreds of patients, thousands of patients in the CIBMTR registry and the clinical trials, and you can see that many will do just fine. And you should not like make it a, and then you impact access, right? If you tell someone you cannot drive for 60 days, they'll tell you like, well, this is not an option for them, at least for some of them. So you don't want to be too restrictive.
Very much so. Or you put the patient in an impossible position. Like, I'll be honest, I won't name names, but we've had patients who are from Alaska come down here for CAR-T, and some of them are actually driving back up. And we tell them, it's like, hey, by the way, you're not supposed to drive for 8 weeks. Oh, but by the way, like, obviously, it's cognitive dissonance. You know that they're going to be driving back to get home. And you're right, they can't get the doctor's appointments. They can't do anything without that. So it made sense. I mean, I guess maybe one last question I'll ask you, Taha, or Salman. I mean, do you think things would be different with AxiCell? Going back to your point, Taha, now your other key abstract about a CD28 costimulatory mature domain, AxiCell may be a little bit, you know, angrier, maybe. You tell me if that's incorrect than Lysacel. Do you think this would apply to all? Can you extrapolate from this, you think, to all CAR-T products? Or do you think this is very much a Lysacel-specific phenomenon?
I personally would say, yeah, applies to all of them. It's just going to depend. I think you're referring to like a fast and early loosening of requirements after 14 days. I think it can apply to all of them. provided that you haven't seen a major toxicity. Now, if you're worried about the patient, if they've had a big toxicity, and some products have different toxicities from others, and the timeline can vary too. So you have to factor these things in. But if they've done well, at least in my clinic, if they've done well, then they've done well.
In that line, there is some evidence from a French group and also one from, I think, in Dr. Arij Al-Jawahiri. She did some analysis at Mass General looking at the quality of life for people who develop higher grades ICANS. And most of those people, they do very similar to the ones who do not develop ICANS. If the patient had a, for example, grade 3 or grade 2 ICANS, but then you gave them treatment and then recovered, we should treat them very similar to the ones that we would do for the ones who did not develop. At this point, we don't have a proof that long-term neurocognitive outcomes are different in both these groups, but it definitely needs some more studying. Unfortunately, the issue, there is no formal way of assessing how someone would drive after CAR T. So it's just like an overall eyeball picture. I think the most important person in the room is the caregiver. If they think that the patient is doing well, I think I will trust them and just will not change anything based on product or how the patient did initially with the first treatment.
Very well stated. I completely agree. It really should be personalized. Maybe, Salman, we can have you do one, and then we can take a break to see if some of the listeners have any other abstracts or questions what we've discussed.
I have a couple that really struck out. One of them is this abstract 7508, CCAR2 anti-BCMA product for relapse refractory AL amyloidosis. It's an ongoing phase 1-2 trial. 40 patients are planned to be included. And as they have done 7, the response rate that struck out, like all patients had a CR of disease and rapidly normalization of free light chains for relapse refractory AL amyloidosis without any major toxicity. 5 of the 7 patients had a MRD negative bone marrow. Very good result. That's what we want to see. AL amyloid is slightly different than multiple myeloma, that you want to quickly get the light chains down and you want to treat these patients real quick so that you can avoid damage. I would like to see more details on it, like how many patients had cardiac involvement and how bad was the cardiac involvement, things like that. But it's a good starting point, I think.
And the biggest thing, and you're alluding to this, yeah, because I think last year, a year ago, and I see Dr. Al-Hadidi here, Dr. Thakur, I see a couple of myeloma colleagues even to chime in. I feel like stage 4 cardiac amyloidosis is not the best place to leverage CAR T, right? There were some cardiac deaths, but they deemed related or unrelated, but I think it's just hard. Those patients can get arrhythmias from CRS or from anything, and that can be fatal for someone with stage 4 amyloid. Here, I think they require stage 1 or 2, right? Or something like that?
Yeah, I think it was limited till stage 3. At this stage 4 was not involved. Again, like it's not very clear. The details are not there, like the numbers-wise, so I would like to read more about it, but I'm very happy to see the results that it does achieve what it is supposed to do, that is rapid reduction of the free light chains, so to prevent further damage. There's another one that attracted me. It's a retrospective review from multi-centers. It's a comparison of outcomes between patients who got therapy with or without HIV, and there was no significant difference in the outcomes between the patients who had HIV or not. I think we should not be discriminating between patients, and we shouldn't be thinking about these patients who have HIV differently compared to the patients who do not. It's a retrospective review, multi-center, but it's good in the regards that the outcomes are very similar. It's abstract number 7076. And it's from Dr. Shanawar Waris from West Virginia.
Yeah, this is excellent because these patients, you said, are often excluded from all these trials, often for no reason.
There are quite a few, like if you see the trend, there are quite a few trials. I cannot remember all of them, but like there are quite a few phase 1-2 trials for solid tumors. Unfortunately, solid tumor CAR T hasn't taken off as much as it has in hematology. Most of the trials that you see a target, there's one on Claudin 18, there's a couple on mesothelin. All of them are early phase. They do show signal, but unless we see a signal in a late phase trial, I don't know. I'm not ready to say that CAR T is ready in solid tumor space. But I will love to listen to Taha's thought about it or your Rahul.
they have work to do for sure. And I'd be curious to see, because obviously it's solid tumors, many of them also have like TCR therapy or like CAR TCR therapy. But yeah, I mean, at least, you know, we've had some patients on the mesothelin studies, for example. And like one of the biggest questions is, will you have any pulmonary fibrosis or, you know, lung issues, is novel toxicities, the way that at least we in myeloma are learning that GPRC5D targeting is not as simple as we thought it was. You know, I'm sure in solid tumors, they're discovering the same thing. So it is hard. Yeah, the target heterogeneity and the fact that there's not as many targets that are truly tumor specific, but dispensable for any on target off tumor effects is hard.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just honestly just going to say it's really fascinating that the scientific piece of it is really is fascinating to me. The clinical piece is that, you know, some of the small studies, even the preclinical studies coming out on the strategies that people are using to hit these solid tumors with T cells and NK cells and other cells, other cell therapies, some of them are almost sci-fi. So whether it's going to work out, like, you know, clinically and long-term, I think it's to be determined.
Agreed. We can talk about one tri-specific for those listening. 7505 by Niels van de Donk and colleagues. It's a tri-specific antibody targeting both BCMA and or GPRC5D on myeloma cells at the same time the CD3 is engaged is pretty cool. The one, maybe one that I'd love to just make a shout out to a fellow at the Mayo Clinic who's been leading this. There'll be a poster, I think, at ASCO and oral at EHA, is poster number 7522 by Dr. Kenneth Lim and colleagues, Dr. Yi Lin from Mayo, senior author, investigating the association between peak post-infusion absolute lymphocyte count and delayed toxicity in myeloma patients receiving cilta-cel. So I see a thumbs up from Salman. Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, it's nice because, you know, we've mainly been presenting a lot of like big CIBMTR or like the pharma-led studies. This is pretty nice that it's a straightforward, you know, hardworking fellow who put this all together. Basically looking, I alluded earlier, that with cilta-cel and CARTITUDE-1, I was saying excellent long-term efficacy, but again, 6% Parkinsonism is a lot. What does it happen? If you'd asked me 2 years ago, and I see Dr. Al-Hadidi and Dr. Takur again, those are your thoughts at the end here, I would have said, oh, it happens because of high disease burden and late line treatment. Not that simple. That's probably part of it, but we're finding more evidence that rapid lymphocyte expansion is either correlated or causative for CAR T cells getting in where they shouldn't get and causing these symptoms. And they find pretty reliably that a ALC threshold of 3000 at any point after CAR T therapy is a pretty good predictor of being at risk for these either Parkinson's disease-ish or other neurotoxicities. The challenge is going to be in the future, people are already starting to do this. I'd love to hear what all of you are doing, both the other panelists and the audience. You know, there's this theory now that, well, if you see someone's ALC rising over 3000, give them Dex, bring it back down, even if they're not having CRS, even if they're not having ICANS, kind of preemptive management of a high ALC, which again, 2 years ago would have been sacrilege. Now people are really thinking about it, particularly with cilta-cel. We are doing it on a case-by-case basis, I'll admit it, Fred Hutch. It makes us all nervous either way, no matter what we decide. The question will be, obviously, if you give someone Dex too early, do you impair CAR T efficacy? We don't know, but we're going to counter-argue that, well, I don't care about the efficacy. Parkinsonism is so bad that you should take that chance, even if you have a low specificity and some patients who end up getting treated who didn't need to, just to make that risk zero. What are you all thinking?
I want to say I'm on surface now. I gave my first cilta-cel Dex 10 for a lymphocyte count of 3,000. I'm not very pro, you know, just giving steroids just to treat a number. But yeah, the expansion of lymphocytes with cilta-cel, even compared to any other product, is quite remarkable, honestly. I come from a BMT allotransplant background. So we do this in transplant. We give GVHD prevention. We try it, and we know if you get out of control T cell expansion and certain clones, you set yourself for problems down the road. So philosophically, I accept the logic here, but whether this is actually what you need to do for this product and these patients, I'd like to see ideally some prospective data on this, but I know some centers are doing studies looking into that too.
Agreed.
And we discussed as a group and decided that we are going to do some steroids for this because the numbers are small, but they are compelling. If you are more than, if you expand more than 5,000, like it's almost 100%, 8 out of 8 patients develop Parkinson symptoms. So that kind of scares me a little bit. Obviously, we need longer data, more data. Right now, I decide on case by case, but I'm more pro towards giving steroids than not, because I fear Parkinsonism is a bad outcome and I don't want to get there.
Agreed.
I was just going to say, any of our listeners want to like comment? This is a very controversial, obviously, topic. Steroids, you know, for a rising ALC, let's just put it that way. Anyone else has any thoughts or comments, pro or against?
I'm also torn, but I would say that, you know, plenty of our patients get Dex and Tosi for CRS, and they do fine, right? I think the MD Anderson data about prolonged steroids impairing CAR T efficacy in the CD19 space, if I recall correctly, was mainly the area under the curve. You know, it's like the, it's not yes or no steroids, but if someone's on steroids for like 2 weeks, those are the patients who have decreased efficacy of the CAR product. And so a couple of days like this is not that unreasonable.
Samer wants to, you want to say something about this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's a great discussion. I mean, as probably all of you know, in CARTITUDE 6, which is just closed enrolling in the US, comparing both transplant and cilta-cel, there was an amendment to add steroids for those with high ALC. I mean, I treated patients on that study, and in practice, I don't think we know if giving steroids is the correct way, because, you know, steroids has their own risk, and the dosing of them being 10 milligrams for 3 days, twice a day, may be either enough or too much for a given patient. So I'll tell you from practice on CARTITUDE 6 that for one, I give steroids, for one, I did not give steroid. None of them got any neurological toxicities. They're a few months out of CAR T, and probably we'll need more of predictive measures rather than such an association to know for sure if steroids could have been even harmful for efficacy, especially in frontline.
Very, very well stated.
Yeah, I support that statement too.
Summer, while we have you, not to pick on you, just we know who you are. Any other thoughts or the cool abstracts that came to mind in the CAR T space for you?
Actually, I think CARTITUDE 1 solid data, long-term follow-up, is probably, being a myeloma person, is probably the really good study to look at. We will always love long-term efficacy when it comes to CAR T and on toxicity. This is really a great abstract to look for. But I think when it comes, on the AL amyloid story, another probably difficult patient selection scenario, as probably all of you know, this is not the first time people try to do BCMA CAR T for AL amyloid. And in a JCO paper recently, there was some treatment-related mortality problems that you could have encountered with that. So I think for patients in most need in AL amyloid, those with cardiac stage 3 and higher, and those with multi-organ involvement, I'm not sure CAR T is the way to go. In my opinion, probably bispecifics, maybe a better off-shelf, ready-to-go sort of treatments that being used sporadically between people. So I think, you know, those long-term CAR T data in myeloma, finally we have 1 out of 3 patients, 5 year plus, without disease and without requiring treatments, I would say secondary hematological malignancies on top of what we already reported. I think that's really exciting to see.
Agreed. I totally agree. We talked about it briefly earlier, but you added a really good point for all of them, for the CARTITUDE 1, but for Nexocar. It's interesting. Yeah, because amyloid by definition is a pre-malignant clone for most patients. And so you think that a bispecific timely may be able to knock it out, but who knows? I agree. I'm not the biggest believer in CAR T for amyloidosis, but if you can choose well, you can. Dr. Thakur, we'd love your thoughts. Good to see you, Richa.
I actually wanted to ask a different question. It was more about the Parkinsonisms associated with CAR T. I had seen a couple of case reports about using like ruxolitinib. I was wondering if any of you guys had any thoughts or experience in that case.
I mean, I've seen dasatinib used. I mean, I feel like any TKI may work, at least for some of our other CAR T studies on trial. Like there's been a thought that actually dasatinib at the different TKI, I'll come back to rux in a second, because I mean, like there's some preclinical work that like dasatinib, for example, could shut down T cells temporarily of these toxicities. Rux, I know, is sometimes used for refractory IECHS, like CAR HLH can be used for that. So I think it's an option. We've thought about it for sure sometimes for really patients with, like, honestly, HLH on service. I think the hard part, as all of you know, is just getting approval for it, or getting our pharmacy to agree to just dispense it even without approval is hard, versus at least for Parkinsonism, giving cyclophosphamide is easy. No one will ever complain about that cost-wise. I just wish there was a way to make have an approval for rux or dasatinib or any of them in this context. Other panelists or Dr. Al-Hadid, anything you'd add?
We use Jakafi for both steroid refractory acute and chronic GVHD, and it works very well. It might be. I mean, the dasatinib for the neurotoxicity, there's good data for sure, but it's not as commonly used, at least as far as I know. It's because it could kill the CAR-Ts too. But when you want to kill the CAR-Ts, you probably have other options besides just high-dose cyclophosphamide.
I may be a little lucky. I didn't encounter Parkinson. As a group, a really good number of both products, including cell-to-cell. But one thing we encountered is neurotoxicity is not Parkinson and not ICANS. I mean, this is an evolving entity. As you know, the Harvard group did publish on that recently in Blood paper by using cyclophosphamide in some of those patients. Unfortunately, there was high risk of infection. Even, it was not probably the answer for everybody. But what we tried to do is something done by others is intrathecal chemotherapy. Because when we check for those CAR-T in the spinal cord, when somebody got neurotoxicity, we were able to see them and trying to give those patients rather more a localized sort of treatment rather than a systematic treatment because we worried about the efficacy of those CAR-T. We encountered two cases like that. We treated them and they did really well with the intrathecal sort of triplet combo that we use in other hematological malignancies.
Well stated. Do you have an issue somewhere with your platelets and doing an LP, or has it been reason you'd bump them up and then do the LP then?
No, I mean, both of those patients were not having issues with thrombocytopenia. We're lucky with them, but you probably could have transfused them if needed for the procedure.
Agreed.
The IT chemo concept is very appealing. I don't know if we have anyone here or one of our colleagues from KU. I think they have a lot of experience with doing that IT chemo for neurotoxicity in CD19 CARs. Yeah, it makes sense to try it for this as well. Can I share one more abstract?
Because
I really like this one. So this one is by Dr. Steven Krupp and the UPenn group. It's abstract number 7029. This might honestly be like practice changing in the future for sure. And this is essentially pregnancy and infant outcomes post CD19 CAR-T.
Oh.
A small cohort, maybe 11, 12 pregnancies, but it was pretty safe. And why do I think this is a big deal? Because if you look at your BALL patient, if they get transplant, well, that's a huge punch to their fertility for sure. And if they don't get transplant, then you're talking about 2 to 3 years of maintenance therapies and among other things. So can CAR-T shorten treatment course and be fertility sparing for these patients and for young lymphoma patients too? Recently, one young lady, probably cured from a relapsed large B-cell, and she asked me about this, and I was like, oh, I don't know, there's not much data about this. Now I can cite this data at least. But this is really good to see. I don't know what everyone thinks about this.
It's one of the saddest cases. Yeah, I actually haven't seen this one, but you're absolutely right. It's interesting. I actually used a drug company's global safety database to go back and look for everybody, hundreds of patients. How many? 16 cases. This is a heartbreaking time for them. Yeah, this is a really good point, Taha. Thank you for bringing that up. Do you still use flu and Psy? I actually don't know. Do you know what they use for lymphodepletion? I don't know if those cross the placental barrier or not. Did they mention that?
They don't. They've done a lot of bendamustine LD with the T-cell, which is, I think, most of the patients here in this abstract. But I don't know if bendamustine versus Flu-Cy, which one is worse for fertility too. And I'm sure this is probably not nothing, but compared to like 2 to 3 years of cytotoxic chemotherapies and or allogeneic stem cell transplant, I think is remarkable, maybe paradigm in a shift in how you treat these patients.
Agreed. Thank you, Taha. This is cool.
Yeah, this is cool. I have to read it to absorb it.
I can think of at least 3 or 4 other myeloma CAR-T ones. Like CARTITUDE 4 was presented, updated, or will be presented. Dr. Sidan and colleagues can talk about that. At EHA, there'll be data for anito-cel, which is a different BCMA CAR-T. Shared many more CD19 ones as well. Maybe it's okay if we close it out now? I think everyone has to. I think Salman and Dr. Al-Hadid are like, Salman and Salman are physically there. Many of you probably listening are physically in Chicago. Go enjoy the sun.
Yeah, I agree. I think we all agree that STAR abstract is the long term data from cilta-cel.
Agreed. Great.
Happy afternoon.
Happy weekend. See y'all later.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We hope you found our discussions enlightening and relevant. offering you a deeper understanding of the present and future of cancer treatment and research. Make sure to join us again for more insightful episodes as we continue to bring you expert opinions and the latest developments from the forefront of oncology and hematology. Please subscribe and leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. For additional resources and episodes, visit our websites at www.cancernetwork.com and www.astct.org.